Today we continue our Moto System series by looking at the basal ganglia and the diseases associated with the basal ganglia. In today's lecture, we're going to cover these 7 objectives. We're going to identify the components of the basal ganglia, and we're going to discuss the general governing principles. We're going to talk about the direct and the indirect pathway within the basal ganglia. We are going to talk about the influence that the basal ganglia has on cortical activity. And then we're going to relate the direct and indirect loop and all the other concepts that we talked about that govern the basal ganglia to diseases such as Parkinson's and other hyperkinetic diseases such as hemiplegia and Huntington's. And then we look at some treatment modalities that can be useful in managing these conditions. So we have a 60-year-old man who is brought to his physician because they're saying that he's not been himself, and the symptoms that has been associated with him not being himself. We have a reduced facial expression, monotonous speech, he has increased tone in the muscles of his arms, and slowed spontaneous movement. Because of all of this and all the other investigations that they did, they were able to diagnose him with the disease of the basal ganglia. But we want to know, as we begin our discussion, what are the components of the basal ganglia? So this question is asking you, of this list here, which of these is part of the basal ganglia? Your crus cerebri, is that part of the basal ganglia? What's the next name for the crus cerebri? Cerebral peduncles, okay? So this is not part of your basal ganglia. Your internal capsule, no, it's closely related to it in terms of location, but it's not part of the basal ganglia. What about the hypothalamus? Nope, not part of it. Then we have the putamen. Is that part of the basal ganglia? Yes, so the putamen is one of the nuclei that is involved with the basal ganglia activity. And we have the red nucleus. Is that part of the basal ganglia? No. All right. What about the thalamus? So the thalamus is not part of the basal ganglia, but it's very closely associated with it in terms of its function. Okay, so 77% of you were able to get that correct. So where is the basal ganglia when we think about the organization of our motor system? As we discussed on the first day of this motor series, your basal ganglia and your cerebellum, they're responsible for modulating the output that comes from your primary motor cortex. So as we can see in this diagram, the output that's coming from the primary motor cortex goes to the basal ganglia, also goes to the cerebellum, and your basal ganglia is going to modify that output, relate to the thalamus. So for this reason, the thalamus is not part of the basal ganglia, but the information from the basal ganglia is relayed to the thalamus, and then it is sent back to your primary motor cortex, and it's also sent to your premotor cortex, which is responsible for your programmed activity, as we discussed. Once that is done, the activity is then carried out, and the information is transmitted via your corticobulbar, corticospinal, and all the other pathways that we talked about. So let's talk about the components of the basal ganglia. So your basal ganglia is made up of several different parts. We have our striatum, which is a combination of our caudate, nucleus, and our putamen. So this is what we saw in the question before. Then we have our globus pallidus. And your globus pallidus has an external and an internal part. The internal part of the globus pallidus is also called the medial part of the globus pallidus. And in this discussion, we'll be using the terms GPI and GPE. GPE being the external or the lateral part of the globus pallidus, and GPI being the internal or the medial part of the globus pallidus. Now your GPI, or the medial part of the globus pallidus, is the main output source from your basal ganglia. So we saw that the basal ganglia communicates with the thalamus. It's your GPI that's going to be taking the information from the basal ganglia to the thalamus. It's the chief output nucleus. Then we have our subthalamic nucleus. This is also part of the basal ganglia. And we have our substantia nigra. Now, where do we find the substantia nigra? In the midbrain. Very well, if you think about the midbrain like the Mickey Mouse, okay, just below the ears or the crus cerebri, that's where we'll find the substantia nigra. And your substantia nigra has two components. We have the pars reticulata and the pars compacta. How does the basal ganglia influence motor activity? It's able to influence motor activity, as we discussed, because it modulates the information that comes from our cortex. So in this little diagram here, you see that the cortex is going to send information to the basal ganglia. The basal ganglia modulates that information. It's relayed to the thalamus. The thalamus sends it back to the cortex, and the activity is carried out. Now, you also have input to the basal ganglia coming from the substantia nigra, all right? And we're going to principally be talking about the substantia nigra pars compacta in this discussion, now, because this input is so significant. The substantia nigra pars compacta and reticulata are closely associated with the basal ganglia. Now, dopamine from the substantia nigra pars compacta is going to regulate your basal ganglia. And in a few slides, I'll show you how exactly that regulation is done. And this regulation allows for further modulation of the information that is sent to the basal ganglia. And in a few slides, we'll discuss exactly what dopamine does to the basal ganglia. So we said that our GPI is going to be the chief output nucleus for the basal ganglia, your GPI being the medial aspect of your globus pallidus. And your GPI is going to exert an inhibitory effect over your thalamus, and therefore, indirectly, an inhibitory effect on the cortical activity, okay? And this inhibition is modulated by two pathways, our direct pathway and our indirect pathway. Now, what is the function of the direct pathway as it relates to the basal ganglion modulating activity? Your direct pathway is going to facilitate movement. Your direct pathway facilitates movement. And how it does that? It does that by disinhibiting the thalamus. So what do we mean by that? Remember, earlier we said that our GPI has an inhibitory effect. So it's going to inhibit the thalamus. The thalamus is going to inhibit the cortex in terms of activity. So your direct pathway is going to basically decrease the inhibitory effects of your GPI, or the medial aspect of the globus pallidus. And thus, it's said to disinhibit the thalamus, or allow the thalamus to go free to do what it wants to do. Yeah? your indirect pathway is going to inhibit the thalamus, or it basically promotes the activity of the GPI. So therefore, your thalamus will not be allowed to be free as it wants to be, to do what it wants to do. So these two pathways are actually nicely balanced, and that balance allows us to have smooth, purposeful movements. So this is what we just spoke of, our GPI. What is the general effect of output from the GPI to the thalamus? Okay, 72% of you are able to get that correct. Your GPI is going to inhibit the thalamus. And this is an important concept for you to understand as we go into discussing the direct and the indirect pathway. Your GPI inhibits your thalamus. So let's start with the direct pathway of the basal ganglia. So we notice in this diagram we have our cortex, the striatum, which is the putamen and the caudate. We have our GPI, which is a medial aspect of the globus pallidus, or which is called your globus pallidus internus. THL being the thalamus, and we see we have here the spinal cord. So from the cortex, we would have decided that you wanted to do an activity, okay? That information moves from your premotor areas and goes to your premotor cortex. And your premotor cortex is going to send an excitatory signal to your striatum, okay? Your striatum now is going to send an inhibitory signal to your GPI. Remember we said the GPI, its output is going to inhibit the thalamus. So therefore, if we inhibit the GPI, the globus pallidus internus, we are therefore going to decrease the amount of inhibitory activity it has over the thalamus. So therefore, our thalamus will become disinhibited, or it would be freed. Once it is free, so to speak, it's going to send excitatory impulses to the cortex, and the cortex is going to interpret that as go ahead in this particular fashion. And therefore, we'll have the projections from the cortex, whether you're a corticobulbar or corticospinal pathways or whichever pathways, to the spinal cord or the brainstem, and that is going to facilitate movement. So we see that the direct pathway facilitates movement by disinhibiting the thalamus. The indirect pathway. Your indirect pathway works oppositely. In that, it's going to diminish movement. So in this diagram, we saw all the structures that we see all the structures that we saw in the direct pathway. In addition to that, we see our GPE, which is the external part of our globus pallidus. And we see our STH, which is representing your subthalamic nucleus. So again, the cortex sends an excitatory impulse to the striatum. The striatum now is going to send an inhibitory impulse to your globus pallidus externus. All right, so we're seeing here that we're not going directly to the GPI, but we're actually going around it, hence the name, the indirect pathway, okay? So the striatum sends an inhibitory impulse to the external part of the globus pallidus. And your globus pallidus, what it is responsible for doing is it is responsible for inhibiting your subthalamic nucleus. So therefore, if you have an inhibitory response to the globus pallidus externus, that is therefore going to inhibit its effect on the thalamus. So because now the thalamus has been disinhibited, so to speak, it is going to send excitatory impulses to your internal part of the globus pallidus or your globus pallidus internus. And once you've excited the globus pallidus internus, you are going to increase the output, the inhibitory output. And so therefore, our thalamus is going to be inhibited. This information is going to be sent to the cortex, and the cortex is going to interpret that as, okay, bring it down, slow it down, okay? And that is going to be sent, transmitted along your motor pathways, whether your corticospinal, cortical bulbar, or the other ones that we spoke about. And the effect is going to be diminished movement. So we see that the direct pathway diminishes movement through excitation of the globus pallidus internus, which inhibits the thalamus. So as I said earlier, for us to have normal, purposeful activities, I'm not sure why this, it's not showing fully, but anyway, for us to have purposeful and smooth movements, we must have a nice balance between the direct and the indirect pathway. And this balance is actually very, very delicate. And if it's tipped in one direction or the other, we can have hypokinesis or hyperkinesis. Hypokinesis means that you're now favoring the indirect pathway, and hyperkinesis means that you're favoring the direct pathway. So as we continue, we will look at some hypokinetic and hyperkinetic lesions, and we'll see why they come about. Now, so we know how the direct pathway works. We know how the indirect pathway works. Now let's consider the effect of dopamine, which comes from your substantia nigra pars compacta. Let's consider the effect of dopamine on these two pathways. So dopamine is going to have a differential effect on the neostriatum as it relates to your direct and your indirect pathway. Now, in the neostriatum, we have our D1 receptors and we have our D2 receptors. Our D1 receptors are specific for the direct pathway, and your D2 receptors are specific for the indirect pathway. When dopamine comes in contact with your D1 receptors, which is part of your direct pathway, we will have the facilitation of movement, because these receptors are going to have this combination of dopamine and receptor will give you an excitatory impulse or excitatory activity, which is going to promote the activities of the direct pathway, which means it's going to promote movement. However, when we look at dopamine's effects on the D2 receptors, which are part of the indirect pathway, it inhibits, has an inhibitory effect on the D2 receptors. And so therefore, it's going to decrease the activity of the indirect pathway. And if you decrease the activity of the indirect pathway, you are going to be facilitating movement. So if you put it all together, our dopamine from the substantia nigra pars compacta is going to facilitate movement. And it does so in two ways. One, by promoting the activities of the direct pathway, and two, by suppressing the activities of the indirect pathway. Good. So now that we've covered the direct and the indirect pathway, and we looked at how dopamine is able to influence these two pathways, we can now study some disease processes. So let's begin by looking at Parkinson's disease. Now, in Parkinson's disease, you have an insufficient release of dopamine from your substantia nigra pars compacta. So if you have an insufficient release of dopamine, what is this going to do? As we said in the last slide, dopamine facilitates movement. So if you have a decreased amount of dopamine, you are going to promote a condition where movement is suppressed. And you do that both by the direct and the indirect pathway. Okay? So let's talk about it. So we see all the different components here of the basal ganglia. And you notice that the substantia nigra pars compactus kind of faded out. That's because there's it's representing the degeneration that's happening to those cells in the crustacerebri. So if you have less dopamine being released onto your D1 receptors, it means that you have less excitation of your direct pathway, which is going to be equal to less movement or less facilitation of movement. If you have decreased dopamine onto your D2 receptors, it means that the inhibitory effect of dopamine on the indirect pathway is suppressed. And so your indirect pathway is able to function more effectively, if you want to say it that way, because now dopamine is not suppressing its activity. It's going to do what it does naturally, which is to inhibit or suppress movement. And so those two net result of all of that would lead to hypokinesia. So who is affected by Parkinson's disease? It usually affects persons who are over the age of 55 or roundabout. And the cause is not established. There are many associated factors that are associated with Parkinson's disease, and we see some genetic predilection, especially in those persons who have alpha-synucleins and Lewy bodies. Now, your catecholaminergic cells are among the degenerating cells in persons who have Parkinson's disease. So apart from the degeneration of your dopamine, there are also other catecholaminergic cells that are affected, okay? And we have, of course, the dopaminergic cells, the noradrenergic pontine locus coeruleus cells, and we have autonomic noradrenergic cells being degenerated also. Now, what are the clinical features in Parkinson's disease? Now, this list is by no means exhaustive, but I just put it here to help us to have a snapshot of the major clinical features that we see in Parkinson's disease, okay? So we have bradykinesia, means that you have slowed movement, okay? So they have bradykinesia or akinesia. Akinesia means no movement. Sometimes it's used synonymously with bradykinesia, but this is basically no movement, and that's because the muscles become so rigid that movements are difficult or impossible. There is a resting tremor in persons who have Parkinson's disease, and it's important for you to know this. There's a resting tremor. In other diseases that we'll study, you'll see that there's an intention tremor. So Parkinson's disease has a resting tremor. There's also a rigidity, and the rigidity is described as a cog wheel rigidity. Okay, so yesterday we looked at assessing tone. Was it yesterday? It was yesterday. We looked at assessing tone in patients, and we saw that we can basically passively move the limbs to assess the tone. Now, these patients with Parkinson's disease, as you try to move the limbs, you will see it will be like that. Okay, so this is what's described as the cogwheel rigidity that is associated with Parkinson's disease. There is decreased facial expression. The patients are said to have a mask-like face. Okay, so they have decreased blinking and so on. They have short strides, and these short strides usually call a fascinating or shuffling gait. Persons with Parkinson's disease has a shuffling or fascinating gait. They have flexion of the trunk and abnormal postural adjustment, so it's easy for them to fall. Okay? And one thing to note is that initially this disease starts, it usually affects one side of the substantia nigra is usually affected, and then eventually it moves on to a bilateral disease. So patients would usually, if you catch them early, they would usually present with symptoms on one side. And then later in the disease, you see both sides being affected. So we have a 69-year-old man. He has a one-year history of difficulty moving. What's the difficulty that he has? He has a slow shuffling gait, reduction in facial expression, hypertonia, and a resting tremor. So all these symptoms, as we saw in the previous slide, classical for Parkinson's disease. And Parkinson's disease is a hypokinetic disease. So which of the following is responsible for the patient's hypokinesis? We have this inhibition of the thalamus. So we're starting from E. This inhibition of the thalamus would result in hypokinesis, or will it result in hyperkinesis? Will it facilitate movement, or will it diminish movement? This inhibition of the thalamus. It's going to facilitate movement, all right? So when you disinhibit the thalamus, you're allowing the thalamus to be free. So then it's going to facilitate movement. So this is not going to be associated with hypokinesis. Inhibition of the D2 receptors. This is the effect that we see with dopamine on the D2 receptors in the striatum. So when dopamine comes in contact with the D2 receptors on the striatum that are associated with the indirect pathway, we see an inhibitory effect. And if we inhibit or suppress the indirect pathway, well, then we are going to be doing what? Facilitating movement or suppressing movement? We're going to be facilitating movement. So this is not going to be associated with hypokinesis. Excitation of the D1 receptors, that's going to facilitate movement again. That is seen with dopamine coming in contact with the D1 receptors associated with the direct pathway. Decrease output from the GPI. Is that going to cause, is that going to facilitate movement, or is that going to suppress movement? It's going to facilitate movement because your GPI, we said its output is inhibitory in nature. And then A, increase output from the GPI. Would that suppress movement or facilitate movement? It's going to suppress movement, and so therefore this can lead to hypokinesis. So how are we going to manage patients who have Parkinson's disease? Well, there are several routes that we can take in terms of medications. We can give L-DOPA, which increases the amount of dopamine present for patients. So L-DOPA is converted into, it increases the synthesis of dopamine in the surviving neurons of the substantia nigra pars compacta. Now, it's important to note that this is a degenerative disease. And so with time, the symptoms is going to get worse and worse. And so these drugs that are trying to increase the effects or the synthesis of dopamine is eventually going to become less and less useful for patients. So, of course, the first line of management would be medication, but eventually the patient sometimes becomes refractory. They don't respond very well to the medication. Now, your carbidopa is usually given in combination with L-DOPA, because it helps to reduce the peripheral metabolism of L-DOPA, so you have more available for the patients. You can also give a dopamine receptor agonist. So instead of trying to make more dopamine available, we can also give an agonist to these patients, and of course the agonist is going to have a similar effect on the D1 and the D2 receptors as dopamine. Antiviral therapy has also shown some use in Parkinson's disease, and patients' symptoms such as the rigidity and the akinesia has been seen to be very responsive to these types of medication. We can give inhibitors of monoamine oxidase. These are going to help to improve the responses in patients who have Parkinson's disease. Okay, this is also going to help in preventing the degradation of our dopamine. And we have our COMT, or catechol methyltransferase inhibitors. These are also useful in preventing the degradation of our dopamine. Now, anticholinergics have been shown to be useful in treating patients who have dopamine, although there's some side effects that are associated with it. Now, why are anticholinergics useful in treating patients who have Parkinson's disease? Your acetylcholine and dopamine exert opposite effects on your striatopallidal cells, okay? So if you think about what dopamine does to the D1 receptor and your D2 receptor, acetylcholine is going to have an opposite effect. So therefore, if you give muscarinic antagonists, it should be able to promote normal kinases, I should say, not hyperkinesis, in patients who have Parkinson's disease. So your muscarinic antagonist is going to be working as dopamine works, if you understand. Yes? Let me say that again. I'm seeing some faces that seem puzzled. So your acetylcholine has an opposite effect on the D1 and D2 receptors as compared to dopamine. So dopamine is going to excite your D1 receptor, which is going to facilitate movement via a direct pathway. So therefore, acetylcholine is going to suppress it. So if acetylcholine suppresses D1, we're talking about decreasing activity. And then dopamine on your D2 receptors is going to inhibit the D2 receptors, and therefore allow for the facilitation of activity. So therefore, if we give a muscarinic antagonist, it's going to be working in the same way as dopamine on the D1 and the D2 receptors. So therefore, your muscarinic antagonist is going to facilitate movement, while your acetylcholine is not going to facilitate movement. I hope you get that. All right, so surgical ablations, we can actually go into the brain and we can do some ablation. What can we ablate? The subthalamus. Now, if we take out a piece of the subthalamus, it means that we're decreasing the excitatory impulses coming from the thalamus onto our GPI. So if we decrease the excitatory impulse on the GPI, and here in the diagram we have it as GPM, same structure, it means that we are allowing for less activity of the GPI, which means that we are going to be promoting movement. We can also have some surgical ablation to the globus pallidus internus. And we did say that the internal aspect of the globus pallidus is the chief output center for the substantia nigra, and its output is inhibitory. So if we take a piece of that off, well, then we're decreasing the inhibitory output from the basal ganglia, and therefore we're allowing for the thalamus to be disinhibited and therefore promoting movement. We can also put electrodes into the components of the basal ganglia, and this can help in promoting activity. This is usually done for patients who are not responding very well to medications, and usually, as we said, we will see that poor response to medications in a later stage of the disease. So we can stimulate our neostriatum, and we can stimulate also the thalamus and the subthalamus. And this is said to allow for better response to the drugs that are used to manage Parkinson's disease. Now, apart from a degeneration of the substantia nigra pars compacta, Parkinson's disease can arise because of other factors. It can be drug-induced, all right? So we have several drugs that can induce Parkinson. We have antipsychotic drugs, which are basically dopamine receptor blockers. It can be due to vascular syndrome. So if you lose the blood supply, of course, to your substantia nigra pars compacta, well, then you will lose the ability to produce dopamine, and so we can have a vascular form of Parkinson's disease. It can be traumatic in nature, all right? And this has been shown in patients who've had multiple head injuries. So for example, boxers, all right, usually have a lot of blows to the head. They can develop Parkinson's disease. Can be due to infections, all right? So viral encephalitis can lead to degradation or degeneration of your substantia nigra pars compacta, or it can be due to neoplastic lesion affecting our substantia nigra. So now that we've covered Parkinson's disease, which is a hypokinetic disease, we can now move on to look at Huntington's disease, which is an example of hyperkinesis because of a lesion affecting the substantia nigra, affecting the basal ganglia, sorry. Now, how do we develop Huntington's disease? It's a result of destruction of the striatal neurons that express D2 receptors. So in Huntington's disease, we're taking away our D2 receptors. And we did say that the D2 receptors are important because when we have dopamine coming in contact with the D2 receptors, it's going to suppress the activity of the indirect pathway. And so if we suppress the activity of the indirect pathway, we allow for movement. So therefore, patients who have Huntington's disease would usually present with hyperkinesis because we are affecting our D2 receptors. All right, so let's go through the diagrams. Of course, we have all the components here that we spoke about as it relates to our basal ganglia. So we see our substantia nigra is going to be releasing dopamine onto our D1 receptor cells and the D2 receptor cells. And in the diagram, you would see the D2 receptor cells are grayed out, meaning that they're degenerating. There's not much of them there. And so you will not be able to have the normal effect that we see with dopamine coming in contact with the D2 receptors. So therefore, we're not going to be inhibiting or suppressing this pathway as effectively. Okay, so there's reduced inhibition of the thalamus. So remember, we said that in the indirect pathway, our subthalamic nucleus is going to release an excitatory impulse that causes our GPI to now suppress the thalamus. So in Parkinson's disease, we will have less of this happening. So therefore, we will be allowing for more movement or hyperkinesis. Is that clear? Now, it is important to note that even though the disease is due to degeneration, in the initial stages, we do have some D2 receptor cells that are still functioning. And so in terms of management, we can try to work on those D2 receptor cells that are there. And of course, as the disease progresses, well, then most of the cells are going to be affected. And so the medical management via medications may not be so useful. Now, who is affected by this disease? Usually persons younger than those that we saw with Parkinson's. And it's an autosomal dominant disease that causes degeneration of the brain. Now here, we can see that there is atrophy of the cortex. Can you see that? We also see that the ventricles seem larger. So these patients, apart from the hyperkinesis, they also have other cortical deficits. So we have the prefrontal and striatal cells being highly vulnerable. So if we have the prefrontal cells being highly vulnerable, we're looking at what type of our prefrontal area, as we discussed, is responsible for what? Prefrontal. Your prefrontal is responsible for motor planning, We also said it's responsible for judgments, all right? You would have learned that, I'm sure, in your behavioral component, okay? So these patients will have a varied array of symptoms as it relates to cortical deficits. Now, how can we treat these patients? We can take several routes. So they usually present with depression. So, of course, we would want to give them antidepressants to help to combat the depression as associated with this disease. We can also give D2 receptors antagonists. D2 receptors antagonists. Now, we know that when we stimulate the D2 receptors, as we saw, the effect of dopamine on the D2 receptors is that it's going to suppress the indirect pathway, which is responsible for suppressing movement. So if we give a D2 receptor antagonist, we are going to be exciting the indirect pathway. You understand? I know. I see most people shake their head. This particular area is an area that usually gives students challenges. Okay? So what's the effect of dopamine on the D2 receptors? Or the indirect, let's put it this way. What's the effect of dopamine on the indirect pathway? Is it going to suppress it, or is it going to facilitate its activity? It's going to suppress it. So when we suppress the indirect pathway, are we facilitating movement, or are we suppressing movement? We're facilitating movement. So someone who has hyperkinesis, do you want to facilitate movement, or do you want to suppress movement? We want to suppress movement. So therefore, we are going to give these patients a D2 receptor antagonist, something that is working opposite to what dopamine does. So dopamine suppresses the indirect pathway. We want to give a drug that's going to excite the indirect pathway. Is that clear? So if we excite the indirect pathway, therefore we're causing it to be more active. If it's more active, we are going to be suppressing movement, and so we're actually going to be decreasing the hyperkinesis that is seen in these patients. So just take some time and think about that a little bit more, and if it's not clear for you, we can talk about it. Apart from the antidepressants and the D2 receptors antagonists, we can also use vesicular monoamine transporter inhibitors to basically manage these patients. Now, what we didn't talk about is our neurotransmitters that are associated with this pathway. And since we have some time, let me just quickly run through it. So from the cortex, we see that the neurotransmitter that is associated with the cortex communicating with the neostriatum is your glutamate. And we know that is excitatory in nature, all right? So from the cortex, we're going to have an excitatory impulse to the neostriatum via glutamate. Your neostriatum is going to give out inhibitory impulses via GABA, okay? And your GPL is going to communicate with your subthalamic nucleus via GABA also. And your GPM is going to communicate with your thalamus via GABA also. So please take note of the neurotransmitters that are associated with the communication that is involved in the basal ganglia. So other diseases that can give you hyperkinesis, so we have other chorionic diseases. So chorea is associated with hyperkinesis, and it's something that's very common in patients who have Huntington's disease. It's also called Huntington's chorea. And once you look at once you use the link that I have in your additional resources, you will be able to actually see patients who have these diseases and the characteristic movements associated with them. Right, so chorea and atytosis, these are hyperkinetic conditions. Apart from Huntington's disease, we can see this in Sydenham's chorea, which is basically due to rheumatic fever. And I think you would have had a case of this early in the term. It could be drug-induced because of treatment with Parkinson's disease. So in this way, it can be drug-induced because of Parkinson's, yes, disease treatment. So you can actually tip the patient onto the other side, okay? Because we know with Parkinson's disease, you're trying to increase movement. All right? So in some cases, you actually might increase it so much that they end up with hyperkinesis. And then we have atytosis, which is a striatal or thalamic injury. And it usually leads to continuous writing of the joints, especially for the upper limb. Hemibolism, or hemibolismus. Now, hemibolismus is associated with a lesion of the subthalamic nucleus. And we did say that the subthalamic nucleus is part of the indirect pathway. And being part of the indirect pathway, it's going to be associated with suppressing or facilitating movement. It's going to be associated with suppressing movements because, as we see, it has an excitatory effect on our globus pallidus internus. So therefore, if we have a lesion to the subthalamic nucleus, we are going to decrease the effects of the indirect pathway, and with decreased effect on the indirect pathway, we are therefore going to allow for the facilitation of movement, more movement than we want. Okay, so now our balance is tipped to the side of the direct pathway, which facilitates movements. And specifically what we see in these patients is hemibolism, all right? So they usually have these uncontrolled flailing movements of the contralateral side of their body, okay? So we have a patient here with bradykinesia, rigidity. He has progressive cognitive decline. And he is diagnosed with a neurodegenerative disorder. Most likely this disorder is what? Parkinson's. Above the symptoms, we also see that he is responsive with treatment of L-DOPA and carbidopa. Okay? So what is the neurotransmitter associated with this disease? All of you should, okay, 82%, that's good. All right, so dopamine, all right? Of course, we know that with dopamine, you have decreased, with Parkinson's disease, you have decreased amount of dopamine, and hence it yields those characteristic signs of hypokinesia. Which of these is classified as a hyperkinetic condition? When we talk about hyper and hypokinetic condition, we're usually talking about diseases that affect the basal ganglia. Okay? But apart from that, with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, do you expect these patients to have hyperkinesis? No. All right? We're going to be affecting our lateral columns and our ventral horns. So they're not going to have hyperkinesis. Sorry, hyperkinesis. They will not have hyperkinesis. Myotonia congenita, we studied that yesterday. That's a disease that affects the motor unit. Again, it's not going to give us hyperkinesis. Poliomyelitis, no, we're affecting our lower motor neurons there. Parkinson's disease, this is completely opposite to hyperkinesis. So we have Huntington's disease, which is a hyperkinetic, very good condition. Okay, you may take your break and we'll return for the next session.